Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, coming up today, we'll look at an effort to save some endangered land in northern Pinellas County. And later on, we'll talk with a group that has awarded a new award for Misinformer of the Year. Which agency or news outlet in the U.S. was most responsible for misinformation in 2020? We'll hear about that later on in the program. Thanks for tuning in. This is 88.5 FM. Well, in Tarpon Springs, there's an effort to save a parcel of land that potentially could be developed. And it is a parcel of land that is the home to eagles and gopher tortoises and wading beards, birds and deer, and a wide variety of native plants. Joining us now is Peter Dalicos, who's president of Concerned Citizens of Tarpon Springs and Friends of the Anclote River. And Peter, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Rob, this is a pleasure to be here. I have to thank you. We're so grateful and appreciative of this opportunity. And we believe that it's important not only for us here in Tarpon Springs, but it's important for the whole community of Pinellas County. From this effort that we've been doing, we found that there are a number of groups that have been fighting for little small parcels that are left here in Pinellas. There's the Gladys Douglas in Dunedin that you're aware of. There's the West Klosterman Preserve group that's trying to save some school board property adjacent to the 64 acres the county already has in the west part of Tarpon. And then there's the landings down in Clearwater. There's all these little pockets of natural land that we're all gathering together and joining forces to try to preserve and educate the people of this area that they do have a chance and a voice to save some of these parcels and properties. So I want to thank you first off, because it's a pleasure to speak to you. We know how important your voice is, and we thank you for allowing us the platform to share our concerns and voice some information out there to let people know that if they speak out and they're educated about the issues, that they have a potential to help change this and help us in our ultimate goal of making this land a park for all of the public, not just the residents that who will live there in this development.
Well, this parcel of land that we're about to talk about is coming up for discussion this week at the Tarpon Springs Board of Commissioners. So, first of all, let's talk about the land. Where is it in Tarpon Springs?
Well, if you go north on U.S. 19, just after you pass Tarpon Avenue, there's a large uplift over the bridge just before you get to the Anclote. And on the south side of the Anclote River, on the east side of U.S. 19, there's a 74-acre parcel that Walmart had purchased back in 2005, and it's got a lot of wooded areas. It's got two eagle's nests. It's got over 30 gopher tortoise holes. We've been out to look at the property from the backside, and I have to stress here, we did not trespass. We were at the fence, but there's a family of deer there. There's wading birds, and it has a ecosystem that is vulnerable because it does have, from other people that we've spoken with who are in the Florida Native Plant Society, very sensitive native plants. So the land is one of the last remaining pieces of nature in Tarpon Springs that we have the ability to save and make into a park for our residents and tourists to be able to come in and enjoy a little respite from the stresses of the modern world.
Well, this is, so you call it the Walmart property. This is a piece of land that's already been fought over, and my understanding is that you pushed back against Walmart a few years ago and were able to save that land from being the site of a giant Walmart.
Well, let me just give you, kind of made some bullet points here, just to give you a brief history. Walmart came to the city back in 2004, and what happened is they brought their plans, and there was the longest meeting in the history of Tarpon Springs in 2005. We started at 6:30 and didn't get to a vote till after 7:30 the next morning. At that time, I was a city commissioner. I was not a member of the Friends of the Anclote Concerned Citizens, However, I was concerned, and there was a number of us on the board at that time in 2008 to deny their certificate of concurrency, which had expired, such that what would have happened, Walmart would have had to restart the whole process. And at that point, they decided it wasn't worth it. Then after 2008, you know what happened with the financial crisis. They decided at that point they wished to put this property at some point on the market when they determined that they weren't going to put a super center there. They actually went and bought the old Kmart at the corner of Tarpon Springs Avenue and US 19, which was perfect because it already had a light, it already had the structure, and they just went in and redid that building, and that's a perfectly functional Walmart, and they're now a contributing partner to the city at that location. And since then, what we did, we lobbied the city for numerous years. We originally were involved with the Trust for Public Land. They worked as a liaison between us and the city and Walmart. But at the time, Walmart still believed they had the ability to get some commercial value out of it. And then eventually they put it for sale. But in the meantime, we have, over the years, lobbied the city to apply for a Florida Communities Trust grant such that we only would need to put in 25% of the money. The grant would cover the other 75%, and we would. Our ultimate goal is to turn that into a multi-use park.
Who owns the land now, and how? What's the value of the land? What do the owners say is the actual dollar value?
Well, Walmart still owns the land. They had put it up for sale originally at $8.8 million. What the contract is for the sale now, I have no idea. The tax assessor, I believe, values it around $5 million at this time. So as far as what the land is valued, I would have to estimate it's in that range, between $5 and maybe $7 million, depending on who's wanting it. But as you know, developers are coming in and gobbling up these last big parcels, so they are probably driving the price up, but we still intend to win this fight. And then at that time, lobby the city to turn it into a multi-use park.
Well, our guest is Peter Dalakos. He's the former Tarpon Springs City Commissioner. He's the president of Concerned Citizens of Tarpon Springs, also known as the Friends of the Anclote River. And we're talking about efforts to save one of the last large parcels of natural undeveloped land in northern Pinellas County. It's an issue that a lot of communities are facing, trying to save undeveloped land from developers. So who's proposing to buy this land, and what do they want to turn it into, Peter?
Well, the group that wants to purchase it is the Morgan Group out of Houston, Texas. They're a big conglomerate that owns approximately 20,000. If you go to their website, they say they own 20,000 apartments in Florida, Texas, I believe in Illinois, California. And they go in and they put in these projects. They've done a number of them also in Florida. But here's the kicker. They want to put in over 400 apartments, a clubhouse, a pool, five buildings over 50 feet high, 750-plus parking spaces. They want to take out over 1,000 trees, and yet they turn around and say they want to do landscaping. They have a flawed traffic plan, which requires to have two access. The city has, they want to do what they call a residential plan development. And what that is in there, if you build more than 50 units, you have to have two accesses. But they're wanting a variance so they can have just one access on US 19, which is going to create a traffic nightmare on a road that is already classified by Forward Pinellas as an F-rated road. And the way they are structuring their entrance and exit is a right-in, right-out, which is going to force people, if they want to go south down to county to work or school or shopping, that they're going to have to get out, cross three lanes of traffic to get to a U-turn, and then get into the southbound traffic, which is going to be a nightmare, and those people out there know it. Also, there's going to be gated. So the only people that will be able to enjoy whatever is remaining of the natural beauty there will only be for those people who are the residents of that, and the people of Tarpon Springs and those who come to visit Tarpon Springs will not be able to enjoy any of the amenities that we are proposing that property could provide.
Well, you know, as I drive up and down, and as we all drive up and down U.S. 19, there's not many parcels of undeveloped land, I got to say, Peter. I mean, U.S. 19 looks completely different than it did 30 or 40 years ago. This issue comes up before the Tarpon Springs City Commission on Thursday. Is that right?
That's correct. And they're having a special meeting starting at 6 o'clock. And it's technically what they call a continuation of the first meeting. And basically, we have a heartburn a little bit with some of the actions that the city has done with regards to the notification to the public about this, because the city is required, whenever they have land use or zoning or certain conditional use changes, they have to notify people within 500 feet. Now, what has occurred, because they had notified people originally, and the city attorney gave the excuse that because it's a continuation, they don't have to re-notify those people. So we took it on upon ourselves that we needed to educate the people. And that's why I want to stress, I know we're kind of known as the Friends of the Anclote, but truly what we're doing is we're representing those concerned citizens of Tarpon Springs. And just to give you a little idea of what I'm referring to, over the last few weeks, this little continuation gave us the opportunity to get out and educate people. I sent you a copy of the flyers we've produced. I believe you've received them. And we focused originally on the wildlife, but our second flyer was on the traffic. And what we had to do was educate those communities surrounding this property of what was coming, because a lot of people didn't know about it. And secondly, those who kind of knew about it didn't know what they could do to take action to, in a sense, voice their concerns. So what we did is we prepared these flyers, and in these flyers we've put information on how people can either Zoom in, or they can call in, or they can email in their concerns. So we're asking those who know about this that the meeting on Thursday begins at 6, but they can email the city. They can go to the city's website, which is ctsfl.us, Charlie, Tom, Sam, Frank, Larry, Uncle Sam, and then go to the board and committees and look at the agenda there. And in the agenda, it will have all the information with regards to the project and all the plant, all their information. And but at the bottom, there's information how people can participate. So we're asking people to either call in or Zoom in or send in their emails to voice their concerns. And what we found is we walked the neighborhoods this last weekend, and we've been handing out flyers. We've probably handed out about 1,000 flyers over the last couple of weeks. And I would have to say 99% of the people were saying, well, I kind of heard something about this, but I didn't know how I could, you know, voice my concern, or I didn't know when it was coming up. So we've had an education campaign to educate those citizens that they have the ability to voice their concerns and let the Board of Commissioners know that this project is not in the best interest not only of the residents of Tarpon Springs, but the residents of Pinellas County and the tourism potential that this property offers. One of our partners, I would say, because we're an open group. We don't charge dues. We don't have an application for membership. Basically, what we do is we're here for your concerns. We have email lists. We have partners with some of the other environmental groups. And we've gotten the word out, but we are the spearhead for these citizens of Tarpon who are concerned, and we've put out the knowledge that they have the voice and they can speak out and help us convince the board that this is not the best use of this property for those of us who live in this area.
Now, Peter, I know you guys have a Facebook page. Can people see the flyers that you've been handing out as you work the neighborhoods on your Facebook page?
Well, we've posted them there, and some other groups have, but I would also say one of our partners, one of our members, he's with the Florida Native Plant Society, and he lives not less than a half a mile away, and he provided us with drone videos of the property. So if you go to our Facebook page, Friends of the Anclote River, when you pull it up, you can see these drone videos, and you get a better perspective of what's really there on the property. It's almost surrounded by water. You've got a big section along the river on the north side. There's also some wetlands like a U-cut on the bottom which actually has a culvert underneath U.S. 19 where it connects to the Ankle River on the other side of 19. So it's almost like an island. There is connected on the east side to upland, but it's surrounded pretty much almost by water. So there is information on our website, not only about the meeting, about our flyers and our disapproval of their traffic plan and our interest in saving the wildlife and natural fauna that's there.
Peter, is money a question for the city commission there in Tarpon Springs? I mean, are they? Do you have any indication that they might be more willing to go with the developer than with you guys because it's a question of coming up with enough money to purchase the property?
I do not believe that is a issue in the sense that years ago I could forward you an article that was done in the Beacon, Tarpon Springs Beacon, about 2013, where the city manager at that time said he had $1 million available from Penny of Pinellas Fund. And I know the county is willing to participate. They've have reached out to the city previously that they would be willing to participate. Now, as again, what I mentioned about the Florida Communities Trust Grant, everybody knows Amendment 1 passed, and there's two parts to that. There's the Florida Forever, which allows the state to have funds to purchase large properties like that St. Joe property up in the Panhandle. But the Florida Communities Trust Grant Program is for cities, communities, and nonprofits to be able to purchase properties for preservation and use of these natures at 25%. So even if, like I mentioned before, the property may be valued realistically between $5 and $7 million. So let's say $6 million. 25% of that is $1.5 million. Well, according to our city manager, he's already got $1 million in the bank for that. So all we would need is another $500,000 to meet the grant process. So part of the problem really has been the lagging of the city commission and the city manager take any action to apply for these grants. So that's something we've been lobbying. I can send you emails. We've been doing that. We started originally like in around 2012 with our partnership with the Trust for Public Lands. They had issues, I think it was around 13 or 14, where they downsized their office in Tallahassee. So at that time, we lost that option. But we did continue as the friends lobbying the city to apply for these grants, and they lagged and dragged their feet. I can't say as to why they didn't take action. Maybe the board didn't see the value of it at that time, but they took no action, and now we're back in the position where we have to fight off another developer. But I promise you this, we are going to win this, and when we win, we are going to turn our efforts, turn the heat on the board and the city manager, that they need to get their act together and start applying for these grants. Because basically it would only take, like I say, about $1.5 million, maybe $2 million to get this property and turn it into the park, multi-use park that we have proposed to the city for years.
All right. We're almost out of time. We're talking with Peter Dalicos, who is the president of Concerned Citizens of Tarpon Springs, also known as Friends of the Anclote River. And we're talking about his group's efforts to save one of the last large parcels of natural undeveloped land in Tarpon Springs, land that is now home to eagles and gopher tortoises and sandhill cranes, wading birds, deer, and many, many native plants. Peter, let's take a phone call from one of our listeners who's in Clearwater. Liz is in Clearwater and has a question. Liz, thank you for calling in. What's your question?
I wanted to point out that this battle is part of a much larger one, a worldwide battle to save our ecosystems and biodiversity. In the last 50 years, humans have wiped out two-thirds of the wildlife, and this cannot continue. A variety of groups worldwide are supporting a plan to conserve 30% of the world's natural land. And we have to implement that locally and statewide as well. Pinellas and the member cities have to commit to preserving or restoring 30% of land. We have to face up to the fact that growth cannot be unlimited. We cannot keep adding people and buildings and development at no cost. And I think that's very hard for leaders, elected leaders, to face up to and to communicate to citizens. But courageous ones need to do that and say, we cannot keep growing. We can't keep bringing people in, adding businesses, adding development. It's not sustainable. Seas are rising. We've wiped out most of our wildlife. We can't keep doing it.
Liz, thank you. Thank you for making the point. Peter, you brought up earlier the Gladys Douglas Preserve and the West Klosterman property. There's all sorts of efforts in Pinellas County, in addition to your trying to save this land in Tarpon Springs. It is a big problem in Pinellas County. There's a golf course that developers want to turn into a housing project in along the beaches there near the inland waterway in Pinellas County. This is a huge problem.
Well, and I have to thank the Suncoast Sierra Club, and they've kind of formed this Pinellas Coalition Group, which has bonded us together. As Liz had mentioned, there's a number of groups that we're fighting individually, and what we've also done is tried to lobby the county. They do have a list of 60 properties they want to preserve. I think we're like number 15 or 18 on the list. But I would like to highlight something Liz mentioned about the growth. You know, if you drive through Pinellas County and probably Hillsborough and Pasco, you can pass by a lot of these strip centers that are vacant. But developers, they want to go the cheap way. It's easier to go in and grade the land, tear out the trees, put in the infrastructure versus tearing down an old building and redeveloping those properties. So we need to try to get, like she mentioned, our officials to recognize that the best way to really provide for growth is redevelopment of those vacant and derelict properties that can be turned into valuable spaces for mixed use. We have a place in Tarpon on Alter 19 in Mears, which used to be a Winn-Dixie, and there used to be a tax collector's office, tax collector office. The Winn-Dixie moved out. It's vacant. It's probably as big, I don't know, maybe about 20 acres. It could easily be torn down, built into a mixed-use retail on the bottom, residential on the top, and that would provide the growth. But the developers, these corporates, they look at the cheap way to do it. It's easier to come in and do that. But I would like to take a moment, if I can, excuse me.
And Peter, we only have about 40 seconds left, and I want to make sure that we talk about the meeting one more time.
Okay.
Peter, I'm sorry I'm going to have to cut you off, but the meeting is this Thursday at 6 o'clock. It's the Tarpon City Commission meeting, and this pristine wildlife habitat is going to be discussed at that meeting. How can people join the meeting?
Well, as I mentioned, if people go to the city website, charlietomsamfranklarry.us, and go to the boards and committees and click on the agenda, down at the bottom, there's instructions how you can either do it by Zoom, or you can call in, or you can email. That would be the best way because they're going to limit the amount of people that actually can attend. So we're recommending people not necessarily come to the meeting in person, but if you participate virtually, you are considered as being a participant. And we're asking people to send in their emails. Their emails will be read at the meeting such that they can voice their concerns. And those who wish to call in, they may have to wait because the way the process works, the applicant will provide their information. We will provide our information. There'll be questioning, cross-examination, and then they'll go to public comments. So I don't assume public comments will come in until maybe a couple hours into the meeting. However, that is their opportunity to voice their concerns. So I recommend if they don't want to stay on hold, send in your emails. Get your emails in to the commission by about 5:30. On Thursday, because that's kind of their deadline to be able to, you know, gather them all up for their reading.
All right. Well, Peter Delicos, President of Concerned Citizens of Tarpon Springs, thanks for coming on WMNF. And people can find Peter's group at Friends of the Anclote River on Facebook. So, Peter, thanks a lot.
Rob, thank you so much for providing this opportunity. And I have to say, we're grateful that we had the chance at that board meeting a couple of years ago to keep you there because you are also a valuable resource for our community. We love you, and thank you for speaking out for us.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thanks for those kind words. And good luck.
Thank you. We appreciate it. God bless all of us.
You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And in a moment, we're going to talk about the news organization most responsible for misinformation in the country in the year 2020. From California, well, to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, I tell you, this land was made for you. Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings here on 88.5 FM. Well, our next guest says that President Trump's media diet is posing a frightening threat to American democracy in the final days of his administration. He says the president is reportedly seeking advice and comfort from unhinged conspiracy theorists who are urging him on as he tries to overturn the election he lost while raging at those who warn against those elections. In Oval Office meetings over the last few days, he's pushed for state legislatures and congressional Republicans to vote to hand him the election, discussing having the Department of Homeland Security seizing voting machines, and even contemplated declaring martial law and using U.S. armed forces to rerun the election. Our guest is Matt Gertz, senior fellow at the Media Matters Media Watch Group, and they've just selected the Misinformer of the Year, which has had a big influence on the president. And Matt, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Matt, the president's media diet has a lot to do with what the way he views the world, the way he views the COVID crisis, the way he viewed the civil rights protests this past year, and the way he views the election results. And you've selected, I think for the first time, Media Matters has selected a Misinformer of the Year. Tell us about it.
So Media Matters every year selects the media personality or outlet that we believe has produced the most misinformation, been the most important source of misinformation over the previous year. We've given it to Fox News hosts. We've given it to MSNBC hosts. We've given it to other outlets and commentators there. This is the first time we've given it to Fox News as a whole. And it's because this was the year the Trump-Fox feedback loop really became deadly for people in this country. As you said, the president watches Fox News constantly. It is his primary source of information about the world. It is staffed up with people who advise him privately on how to respond to crises. When the coronavirus hit the United States earlier last year, he turned to Fox News and continued to do so for months and months and months. And it had a disastrous impact. It really did get people killed.
Now you said it gets people killed. You say never before personalities and executives at Fox had blood of this many Americans on their hands. That's a pretty strong statement. Let's listen to some of what Fox said this year about COVID-19. And we'll play, and I'm getting these clips from your website. Let's listen back to a little bit of what you've posted on Media Matters.
It's a virus like the flu. It actually can be mistaken for the flu.
This virus should be compared to the flu because at worst case scenario, it could be the flu.
We've shut down an entire country for 0.3% of those who get it lose their lives.
I am far more concerned with stepping on a used heroin needle than I am getting the coronavirus.
I feel like the more I learn about this, the less there is to worry about.
I was about to say the same thing.
One thing we've learned is even when there's an infected person amongst thousands and thousands, in our case, over 10,000 people, it is very, very difficult to contract this virus.
Extremely low lethality or otherwise healthy younger Americans, they do pretty well.
All right, that's just a sample of what you can find on the Media Matters website. They're edited of Fox News people. I cut it off because it goes on and on. But how many times did Fox spread misinformation, according to your research, in 2020?
That over the course of the year, they spread misinformation about the coronavirus 13,551 times.
That's a lot. And you've documented every one of these.
We've documented a great deal of them. The way we calculated this was we did a deep dive through a week of the network's coverage. Every single segment found that they had misinformed the public hundreds of times, and then we made a broader estimation by looking at the number of segments they ran over the course of the year about coronavirus.
Now, last night when he was campaigning for the Georgia senators, the Republicans running in the Georgia Senate runoff, President Trump complained about Fox News. You know, how much of 2020 was he, like, you know, right in there with Fox News? And when did this break, if it's a true break, when did it happen?
So the president has basically been glued to Fox News for years. But throughout that time period, whenever he sees a segment that he doesn't like, he lashes out at the network over it. And we've seen more and more of that over the last several weeks. Basically, what happened was Fox has a decision desk like other networks do, and like other networks, its decision desk determined that Joe Biden had won the election and was president-elect, and he freaked out over that. And so he started lashing out at Fox and telling his supporters that they should be watching some of the network's fringe right competitors, OAN, Newsmax, instead. And that, in turn, is getting Fox to become more supportive of his attempt to steal the election as Inauguration Day approaches.
Well, we're talking with Matt Gaertz, who's a senior fellow at Media Matters, the Media Watch Group. It is a liberal group. Just last week, they named Fox News its Misinformer of the Year for 2020. They had given out the title to Fox employees before and some MSNBC employees before, but this is the first time that the entire network has gotten that that award, if I could call it an award. So, Matt, let's listen to a little bit of what Fox has said about the outcome of the November 3rd election, because tomorrow in Washington, D.C., four groups, including the Proud Boys, are planning to hold demonstrations objecting to the electoral vote naming Joe Biden as the next president. Let's listen to a little bit of what Fox has said over the past few weeks.
We, you, the American people, deserve better. It is a national disgrace how some states have handled this election.
There actually is evidence of fraud. There are individual affidavits that are being filed or will be filed.
Look, the news media doesn't, you know, just anoint the next president.
How dare you ask why dead people are voting? How dare you question the decision desk, plebe? Who are you?
How many dead people voted?
Interesting stories about dead people voting. Wow, amazing. What pre and para elections we all have confidence in.
We believe these people are thieves. We believe the machines are corrupt. The big city machines are corrupt.
Tampering allegations to the dead people voting, to the machines.
Trump has not lost. Do not concede, Mr. President. Fight hard.
Hammer and scorecard. It could be used to flip votes from Trump to Biden.
We saw blatant election law violations in state after state.
Financed by people like George Soros, deeply laid in at the local level. And frankly, I think that it is a corrupt, stolen election.
All right, so that's just a sample. Newt Gingrich there and Sean Hannity. So, Matt, does Fox ever correct itself? I mean, you said they have a desk and they declared Biden the winner of the election at some point in the last 2 months. But do they ever put on corrections to what they say?
They do when they get sued. That's been one of the more interesting aspects of the Fox News support for the president's attempt to steal the election. You have, in a couple of cases, Fox hosts that went after various voting companies, you know, companies that produce voting machines for basically fraudulent, you know, conspiracy theories that votes had been switched back and forth from one candidate to the other. And the companies threatened to sue Fox News and other outlets that had done this. And then you had the sort of spectacle of Lou Dobbs and Maria Bartiromo and then some of the other Fox shows basically putting on, it's hard to describe these segments, but that they're basically like hostage videos where, you know, all of the things that they have claimed about the company are debunked. like clearly these are segments that were produced by lawyers to try to reduce Fox's legal liability. But that's really what it takes to get Fox to change its tune on some of this stuff.
Well, there was a lawsuit by the Seth Rich family. He was the guy that Fox News named as the person who provided WikiLeaks with tens of thousands of pages of DNC, Democratic National Committee documents. Rich was murdered by apparently a failed robbery, but Fox said that he was murdered by dark forces, the deep state forces. Sean Hannity was a big purveyor of that. That the network pushed that story for years and years, and it caused hate calls to come into the Seth Rich family. I don't know if you reported on it, but. You know, that was a horrible moment. Fox never really apologized or retracted anything, or did it retract the Seth Rich story?
They retracted a story that they ran on FoxNews.com, which had made a bunch of those allegations in May, I believe, of 2017. This was basically around the time that President Trump had just fired Jim Comey, the FBI director, over his investigation into Russian interference in the election. It was a really dangerous moment for the president. And so Fox responded by dredging up the Seth Rich story and trying to show that that meant that Russia hadn't really interfered in the election, because it wasn't Russian hackers that got the emails. It was Seth Rich. And that was obviously all lies, and they had to retract it. As you say, Seth Rich's family sued. Fox News recently settled, reportedly for seven figures over this. The reason that they settled at that particular moment was that their lawyers were about to be able to depose Sean Hannity and several Fox executives and others, and that it was likely that was going to produce information that would make the network look very, very bad. And so they ponied up instead. They never retracted anything on air. You had not only Fox News opinion hosts like Sean Hannity, but news figures like Griff Jenkins pushing this story as if it were credulous, and then never returning to it after the fact to say, okay, actually, none of this was true. We got it wrong. That is not generally how Fox operates, and it wasn't how Fox operated in that instance.
Hmm. You know, I won't be able to play them, but there's a whole set of sound bites on your website, Media Matters, in which Fox News hosts say that 99% of people are going to survive COVID. If you have underlying conditions or if you're old, you may be susceptible. But 99%, they say, of people are going to survive COVID. And as I watch that, they were really promoting this idea of herd immunity. As I watch that, it looked to me, and I hope this is fair, it looked like they were willing to sacrifice the weakest in our society for this COVID outbreak, the elderly, the poor, people of color, those with underlying health problems. They seem to dismiss the fact that these people would be susceptible to COVID and downplay it as if we as a country can afford to jettison those folks from our society.
I think that's right. And look, there are two ways that Fox had an impact with coronavirus. One is just telling its viewers that they shouldn't worry about it, that they shouldn't wear masks, that they shouldn't put up with government trying to shut down bars and restaurants and gyms. Convincing their viewers not to take the virus seriously and not to act in ways that protected themselves and members of family and others in society. The second way, of course, is because the president of the United States was one of their viewers, and he was listening, and he was shaping federal policy based on what he was hearing on that channel, up to and including putting Scott Atlas, a radiologist and conservative think tanker with no background in epidemiology or infectious diseases, on the coronavirus White House task force, and having him become one of the key figures in the U.S. response. because he saw him a lot on Fox News and liked the TV appearances. I mean, that's how we got a person with no, with minimal qualifications elevated to the level in which he could help guide the U.S. response and to promote this idea of herd immunity, that we should allow more people to get the virus because most of them will survive and it's not really that bad. That happened because the president is obsessed with a TV channel and just likes to put people that he sees on it into positions of authority. It's really maddening.
So, Matt, before I let you go, tomorrow in Washington, D.C., even today in Washington, D.C., the Proud Boys and other far-right groups are planning to protest the election results. They think the election was unfair. The president certainly thinks the election was unfair, as he said in that famous phone call over the weekend to the Secretary of State in Georgia. I mean, we're seeing groups around the country, protests around the country from people, ordinary people who, and then you've got these far-right people like the Proud Boys thinking that somehow the election was stolen despite all evidence and despite even Republican election officials saying, no way, it didn't happen. There is this giant conservative media empire with Fox and OAN and all the talk radio stations in the country pushing this line. What does that do to our democracy? What do you think is going to happen tomorrow?
I think it puts it in grave jeopardy over the long haul. I think in the short term, I think that the president's attempt to steal the election will fail. I think that Joe Biden will become president on January 20th. But there are going to be millions and millions of Americans who have been convinced by the president and by this media apparatus that the election was stolen from him. And you will have a host of Republican members of Congress and senators who have signed on to a plot to overturn the results of the election and give the presidency to someone who lost the election. And I think in the long term, it becomes more likely that at some point something like that succeeds, that American democracy is an experiment and a fragile one. That may not last in the long term.
Matt, where can people see the article about Misinformer of the Year?
You can go to MediaMatters.org for that and all of your media watchdog needs.
All right. Matt Gaetz, thanks a lot. Do they get a like an Oscar or anything? A little statue?
No, they don't. There is no physical award. They just get our score.
Matt Gaetz, thank you very much for coming on WMNF.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. Well, you're listening to WMNF 88.5 FM. If you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can email us here in the studio, the address dj@wmnf.org. Well, yesterday, Gabriel Sterling, the voting system implementation manager for the state of Georgia in the Secretary of State's office, held a press conference. And at the beginning of the press conference, he was shooting down all the conspiracy theories about the Georgia election. And we're going to listen to this because it was an amazing moment. I don't think it's gotten enough attention since it, but since yesterday. This was yesterday afternoon. Let's go to Georgia. Gabriel Sterling, who's a Republican, shooting down the conspiracy theories about the Georgia election. Listen to what he had to say.
Every person, every voice matters. And I know that there's people who fought for that for years about this. So let's start again. And yes, some of this is going to come out of the continuing statements from the president and some of his supporters. State Farm. All right. This has been one that's been conflated over several different things. We have multiple scan ballots. We have Ruby Freeman. We have the leak that says water main break, which wasn't a water main break. So in order to be fully transparent, one of the things we did, we had a local media organization, WSP, Justin over here. We went through it for hours and hours, walked through frame by frame and showed what happened. So let's start. If you go to securevotega.com, we have posted all the videos from State Farm for that day that cover the relevant periods. 5:23 a.m., the they walk in and they discover what is essentially a pond on the floor where you can see water coming out of the sky. So they say, okay, we can't do our work here this morning. They call in the State Farm people. It's not Fulton County people, which is one of the other things they said. There's no Fulton County work order to fix the water leak. And guess what? It wasn't in a Fulton County facility. It was in State Farm. So they were the ones who fixed the leak. And it was a urinal that was overflowed because they were turned off because, guess what? Nobody's in State Farm because of COVID, other than this particular usage. So they turned off all those things, and it went over the edge of the relief valve, and that's what caused the leak. So they come in. Then you go to another one about 7 in the morning or so, where you have essentially the, I don't know what to call it, the drying Zamboni that's driving around on the carpet, cleaning it all up. Then at about 8:23, you see a woman bring in the table in question that has been the point of Mr. Giuliani's 90-second clip. She's pulling it with one hand, and she sets it down. There's nothing underneath it, okay? Then you can fast forward to later in the day, about 9:45 or so. Everybody there, there are two groups of people there. There's cutters and there are scanners. What happened was the cutters began putting their stuff away because everybody's under the impression they were going to get home. We have discovered this. So they start putting covers over the cutting machines and everything. So then we see also, while the monitors and the press are still in the room, they bring out the carriers, which are normal absentee ballot carriers. And I will admit, when I listened to the audio of the phone call and the president brought that up again and I heard it on a radio ad again today, I wanted to scream. I did scream at the computer and I screamed in my car at the radio talking about this because this has been thoroughly debunked. They bring out the normal absentee ballot carriers. There are monitors in the room. There is press in the room. They take the ballots that have been opened, put them in carrier trays, and put them in there, and then put them in the boxes, put the lid on because the lid matches the box, and then you see, at one point during the video, a woman crawling on the floor, putting the numbered seals on them so they can keep the chain of custody. Approximately 10:25, 10:30, the secretary in our office receives word that Fulton County is shutting down for the night at State Farm Arena. So, as some of y'all who were there on election night recall, the secretary got a little irritated with this and made his feelings quite known. He said, some of us will be working through the night. We're glad to see that Fulton County sees the need to just go ahead and knock off for the evening. So, Chris Harvey, our elections director, then calls Rick Barron, the elections director of Fulton County, who was at the other location, which was their English Street warehouse, because he was doing election day activities. Chris calls Rick. Rick says, we're not shutting down. Well, Chris says, it looks like you are. So then you can go back to the videotape and see Ralph Jones take a phone call of approximately almost 11 o'clock. And you can see his shoulders kind of shrug. He takes the phone call. He's being told at that point by his boss, Rick Barron, you need to stay and continue to scan. So he hangs up the phone, he goes over to some boxes, puts some more seals on them, because obviously, if you watch the videotape, many of the people that are there have been there since 7 in the morning. It's already 11 o'clock at night. They were all under the impression they were going to get to go home. So you see him spend about 30 seconds going, heck, what am I going to say to these people? So then he walks back over to the corner of a desk and says, I got the word, we got to keep on scanning. So they go back to the boxes that you see them put under the table at the approximately 10 o'clock hour. There is videotape of this. And this is what's really frustrating. The president's legal team had the entire tape. They watched the entire tape and then, and from our point of view, intentionally misled the state Senate, voters, and the people of the United States about this. It was intentional. It was obvious. And anybody watching this knows that. Anyone watching it knows that. That's why we released the entire tape for people to watch. So is this claim that was done? So they pull those out and begin to scan. Then the other claim comes from about a woman named Ruby Freeman and multiple scanning. One of the things you need to understand is a normal ballot processing, if there is a problem with a ballot, what it does is it stops. But before that, 4 or 5 will get through. So they say delete that last batch and rescan it so they scan properly. That is the normal process that is done. Secondarily to that, everybody might be familiar with the fact that the president wanted us to do a hand recount, a hand retally, which we ended up doing under our audit. That audit showed that there was no problem with machine scanning. If somebody took a stack of ballots and scanned them multiple times, you would have a lot of votes with no corresponding ballots. So let's go over the numbers one more time. Statewide, it was for the sheer number of ballots, they were off by 0.1053%. For the margin, they were off by 0.0099%. 5%, which shows that the machines scanned properly. Our counties did a great job of following these batches and doing the hand count properly, appropriately, with scrutiny and with observers. So let's put that to bed right now. And one of the other things we did as part of our transparency is we have put all of those tally sheets online for every county so you can go through and look at them all. And it's at, again, the securevotega.com. Let's see. Let's go over the numbers of the president's team is claiming. We have a little chart over here. They're claiming there were 2,056 felons that voted. Our research, and we have better data because we're directly tied to the state government on this, Department of Corrections, and the other department, which I can't remember what it's called right now, basically it tracks when people are on probation. There we go. We know exactly how many people voted for this. We have an hour bound of 74 potential people who are felons voted. What that means is that's the biggest number it could be. We will investigate and find out some of these people completed their sentences. Some of these people have the same name and birth date, so there'll be some crossover there. So 74 is the hour bound. It's going to be lower than that. So let's be clear about that. Then there's the claim that 66,248 people below the age of 18 voted. The actual number is zero. Let me be clear. 66,000 versus zero. And the reason we know that is because the dates are on the voter registration. There are four cases where people requested their absentee ballot before they turned 18, but they turned 18 by the election day. That means that is a legally cast ballot. So again, 66,000, which is the biggest single number they have on these kind of votes, versus zero. They say that there's 2,423 people who voted without being registered. Let's just be clear about this. You can't do it. There cannot be a ballot issue to you. There's no way to tie it back to you. There's no way for them to have a name to correspond back to unless they are registered voters. So that number is zero. Then we've got 1,043 illegally voted using a P.O. box. Again, we're going through the investigation on this. So far, everyone we've seen has been when there is a mailboxes, et cetera, something like that, in a multi-family building, like an apartment. So they'll have what looks like P.O. boxes listed in the system, but they're actually the residential address of record for people who live in multi-family housing, like apartments. So that's everything we've seen so far. We haven't seen anybody actually registering to vote at a USPS P.O. box. Next one is 4,926 voted past the legal registration deadline. Again, it's zero. We have zero record of anybody doing that because the voter registration cutoff is a voter registration cutoff. So there's no corresponding way to do that. They couldn't be issued a ballot because they are not legally within the system of that to have ballots issued. 10,315 who died before the election. Again, our information from the Department of Vital Records, we go through county by county, shows potentially two. So far, two. It could change, it could go, but it's not 10,000. 395 cast ballots in two states. We're investigating that, but again, and we got double voters, which we were investigating. But again, we're talking handfuls, not tens of thousands. Let's remember, and I think we're all very clear on the number now, that it was 11,779. We've seen nothing in our investigations of any of these data claims that shows there's nearly enough ballots to change the outcome. And the secretary and I at this podium have said since November 3rd, there is illegal voting in every single election in the history of mankind because there are human beings involved in the process. It's going to happen. It's a question of limiting it and putting as many safeguards as you can in place to make sure it doesn't happen. All right. Oh, yeah. We had part of the hand tally be discussed in relation to the potential double scanning. Let's just go to the other ridiculous claims that Dominion voting machines are somehow using fractional voting or flipping votes. Again, by doing the hand tally, it shows none of that is true. Not a whit. And let's go back to the overall claims about Dominion voting systems in general. If you look in Wisconsin, they're claiming Wisconsin was stolen through Dominion voting machines. In the 14 counties in which Dominion voting machines were used in Wisconsin, the president got 59% of the vote.
All right, so that was Gabriel Sterling, the voting system implementation manager for the Georgia Secretary of State's office, yesterday going line by line, refuting allegations made by President Trump about the state's voting system and alleged stolen election. It's a much longer video, and I played just a portion of it if you want to link if you can't find a link on your own. If you email me here in the studio, dj@wmnf.org, I'll send you a link to the entire video. It's about 20 minutes long, line-by-line refutation. If you want to comment about today's show, call us up, 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks to Barbara Fling. She's been our phone producer today, working hard in the back. This is WMNF in Tampa. Stay tuned for your hero, Mark Bureau. He's coming up next. Thanks for listening to Radioactivity. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland.